Welcome to Connecting the Drops, a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio and the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. The foundation is the only nonpartisan nonprofit water educator in Colorado, promoting a better understanding of the state's water resources and issues. To become fluent in Colorado water, visit the foundation online at yourwatercolorado.org. We're talking about the Colorado River tonight, broadcasting live on the Front Range and the Western Slope. I'm Eric Scalak, news director for KDNK Community Access Radio, speaking to you from our studio in Carbondale on the banks of the Roaring Fork River, a tributary of the mighty Colorado. The river means a lot of different things to us here on the Western Slope: irrigation, recreation, energy production, tourism, none of which are trivial, especially to Colorado's rural communities. Being near the headwaters, we see an almost immeasurable amount of water passed downstream to distant points in Mexico and the dry Southwest, but some of that water is sent back east, and on the other side of a series of diversion pipes running underneath the Rockies is Boulder and Rocky Mountain Community Radio Station, KGNU. Maeve Conran, news director for KGNU, are you with us?
We are with you. Welcome to all our listeners in the Roaring Fork Valley, listeners to KRCC in Colorado Springs, and KGNU listeners in Boulder and Denver. The irony is not lost on us that, as we discuss drought and the challenges facing the Colorado River system this afternoon, our Front Range listeners are dealing with record rainfall and flooding. Our thoughts are with you, and KGNU's flood information updates will continue after this program. This call-in show is part of Connecting the Drops, a year-long radio series airing on Rocky Mountain Community Radio stations across Colorado in partnership with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. Taylor Hawes is with us in Boulder. She is the Nature Conservancy's Colorado River Program Director. She recently testified before a Senate committee on the Colorado River. Good afternoon, Taylor.
Good afternoon.
And Wayne Vandersheer is also with us. He is the General Manager for Water and Wastewater Planning, Water Resources Engineering, Conservation and Forest Service Asset Management for Colorado Springs Utilities. He joins us by phone from Colorado Springs. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Good afternoon.
Here in Carbondale, our guests are KDNK reporter Amy Hedden Marsh, who's been reporting on drought in the Rockies for the last several months, and Jim Pokrant, education and communication specialist for the Colorado River Conservation District.
We'll kick this conversation off with a question for Jim Pokrant. Jim, I mentioned in our introduction that the irony is not lost on us, certainly in the Front Range, that we're discussing drought in this time of extreme rainfall. Does this mean that the drought is over? Are we out of a drought because of this rainfall?
Well, first of all, we on the West Slope are very much taken back by the pictures of devastation that we've seen from the Front Range. And the power of water is just amazing, especially I think when the Boulder area got as much rain, 10 inches or 11 inches, as, you know, almost what Glenwood Springs gets in 1 year. So, having said that, the cruel irony here is that, no, you cannot say that drought is over. Big summer storms can certainly benefit river flows, and you could see in this case that it's over the top. But what we really are looking at for breaking the drought is whether or not we have a good snowpack this winter and the next coming winter.
And Taylor Hawes, I'll ask you that question, Taylor. All of this water that we're having here falling on us on the Front Range, how does that impact what we're talking about, the future of the Colorado River and water resources in that river?
It's an excellent question. In my perspective, the future will not look like the past, and we're seeing a real change in how we're receiving precipitation. As Jim mentioned, we really need, you know, our whole system is set up around reservoirs. We need to be getting snow. When we get 18 inches of rain in 4 days, that runner water just runs off. This water that we're getting on the Front Range right now is headed to the Mississippi eventually. Now, it will have a temporary impact on the Western Slope and on Colorado River because it reduces demand. We aren't bringing any water over from the Western Slope right now. But that is such a minor amount of benefit to the Colorado River in the long run, because we have Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the two biggest reservoirs in the country, are less than half full. So this it helps, but it's almost too much. It's just we can't capture it. Our reservoir systems aren't structured to be able to capture this much runoff and rain. So we're going to have to learn new ways of managing our rivers because of these new extreme events that we're experiencing.
Is this an argument to have increased water storage, or is this just beyond any capacity for storing water?
This Wayne may have a perspective on this as well, but in my opinion, this is just too much water. We can't capture it. It's running off in all directions. So it does. We could maybe have more storage, but I think those big reservoirs are not the answer. We may need small reservoirs in key locations to be able to capture more of this water.
Well, Jim Pokrant, I'd like to go back to you. Roughly 27 million people throughout the West rely on the Colorado River for water, energy, and healthy ecosystems. Climate studies indicate that the potential for inadequate water supplies throughout the 14,000-mile river system. Is this a crisis?
It's a crisis coming in very slow motion. But in terms of water planning, yeah, it's generational. So you have to treat it as a crisis because solutions can take 20, 30 years, whether it's even policy or building a new project. So I'd say it's a crisis. If people like to have water at their tap when they go to brush their teeth or take a shower, it's a crisis.
Wayne van der Scheer, we'll go next to you. Colorado Springs, you're in a different water basin, but you do rely heavily on the Colorado River water. Tell us why you rely so heavily on the river.
Well, we probably need to look just a little bit at history. After World War II, there was the substantial economic expansion, the expansion of Fort Carson and the Air Force Academy coming to town. And it turned out, as we know across Colorado, there's often the case there's not enough water in the right place in the right amounts at the right time, and we're seeing that now. The supplies we had in the 1950s were insufficient and unreliable, so in the 1950s we built the Blue River system, which is a tributary to the Colorado River near Hoosier Pass, just south of Breckenridge. And today our 500,000 customers and their economy benefits from 4 Colorado River transbasin systems delivered through 3 pipelines, soon to be 4 when our southern delivery system is completed. So in any given year, we're 60 to 70% dependent on the Colorado River, and so we are very interested in both the Colorado River and the amount of snowpack that sits up above it.
Let's talk a little bit about the Colorado River Compact. Every single drop of water in that river is allocated through what is quite a complex system of water law. It's a legal agreement called the Colorado River Compact. Taylor Hawes, what exactly is the compact and what does it do?
The compact is an agreement between the 7 basin states in the Colorado River Basin, so Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, and California. It governs the use and allocation of the water. So back in 1922, when California was developing very quickly, the Upper Basin, in particular Colorado, became very worried that they would not get their fair share of the river. And so in 1922, which happens to be one of the wettest periods in history of the Colorado River, they negotiated agreement to split the river up. So the Upper Basin states, basically cutting off at right below Lake Powell, received 7.5 million acre feet of water, and an acre foot of water is 1 football field 1 foot deep, or 326,000 gallons. The Upper Basin on an annual basis is supposed to get 7.5 million acre feet. The Lower Basin is supposed to get 7.5 million acre feet. Lakes Powell and Meade govern the water, and we equalize those reservoirs to make sure the Lower Basin gets its allocation and we get ours in the Upper Basin. There's a 1944 treaty between the U.S. and Mexico where we deliver additional 1.5 million acre feet to Mexico. And so all of this, the thing about the compact that people need to understand when they start talking about revising it is it's a function of man. We can change it. We do change it all the time. We have side agreements between the states. As long as all 6-7 states can come together and come to an agreement, they can change the compact. They're not changing the underlying structure of the agreement. I think that's important for people to understand. But we can have side agreements that help govern the river more flexibly.
That's Taylor Hawes with the Nature Conservancy's Colorado River. She's their Colorado River Program Director. She recently testified before a Senate committee on the Colorado River. I'm Maeve Conran at the KGNU studio. Back to you at KDNK, Eric.
All right. Well, I'm going to have our reporter Amy Haddon Marsh jump in here. Amy?
I have a question for Jim Pogrant. Can you talk about the Colorado River Cooperative Agreement, which was finally signed in July and was 5 years in the making? Who got what? How does that work?
The Colorado River Cooperative Agreement relates to Denver Water seeking more water from the Fraser River system, principally for the northern end of their system. So they wanted to enlarge actually a Front Range reservoir, Gross Reservoir, near Boulder. Many people will know where that is. And that's where water is received through the Moffett Tunnel from the Fraser River system. So they had to go through a permitting process. As many people know, trying to do a project can become very ugly. And what Denver Water did was they made a business decision and a policy decision to try and hammer out an arrangement where there would be net benefit to the West Slope, all of the West Slope, and in the case of Denver Water, that they would be able to permit this project that would get them 18,000 acre feet more a year, roughly, and help them enlarge Gross Reservoir and firm up their water supply for that end of the system. But what's noteworthy about this is Denver made a business and a political decision to do to make a deal under a new principle of bringing in a lot of stakeholders. So it just wasn't Grand County that was at the table for this discussion. It included Summit County and Garfield County and the River District and all these interests along the main stem of the Colorado. So it's pretty significant in that Denver's political and business decision was to reach out and try and create benefits for the West Slope, while they would be certainly taking a little bit more of the hydrograph in spring to help fill an enlarged Gross Reservoir. They're still not permitted yet, but the way has been almost all the way cleared that there will not be West Slope opposition. And the good part is that if Denver were to want to do another program, another project, it would have to be collaborative and something that West Slope would also want to see.
Well, can you talk about the Shoshone Power Plant in Glenwood Springs, which is owned by Xcel Energy, and the role it played in the cooperative agreement?
Sure. The Shoshone Power Plant is in Glenwood Canyon, and it's the biggest, largest, oldest senior water right on the system, and it's from 1902. And it would therefore call out the Trans Mountain diversions, among many others. So what that does is those who do divert from the Colorado River, if they want to keep diverting when the Shoshone Power Plant call is on, principally from the middle summer through late summer and fall, then they have to replace water or stop diverting. What that does, that creates a steady flow through the canyon, about 1,250 CFS, that benefits the rafting industry, recreation, angling, municipal water users. So it's very important to the West Slope that this water right remain active, because it pulls water down the river, more water than would be there naturally, actually.
And you're talking about the Glenwood Canyon.
I am. And, of course, that assists the West Slope.
Thanks, Eric. I'd like to go next to the phone lines. We have listeners from around the state calling in. First, I'll welcome Carlo, calling from Buena Vista. Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I do not have a question, but I'd like to make a couple points.
Please go ahead.
And, I pleaded my case many a times to the Chaffee County commissioners. I could not see how sustainability would be to take spring water that's natural out of the Arkansas River and truck it to Denver to make bottled water for Nestle, number one. Number two, I don't feel that it's proper in these times that we keep allowing these ski resorts to make water for artificial snow. And during my project looking at the water consumption and the Nestle water for bottling, I looked at the soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I wanted to see if there's any of our soldiers that were dying of dehydration. I found out that no, but there were women dying in their sleep because they wouldn't go to the bathroom after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because they were being raped and stuff. And the association with always grabbing water and taking water from the western slope to the eastern slope is just going against Mother Nature. And I just feel that we keep grabbing water and keep grabbing water, and we just have to start relying on Mother Nature referring back to our aquifers. And if this Keystone Pipeline goes through the United States, it's going to definitely hurt the eastern, southwest, southeast corner of Colorado. And just, I think we have to really put the brakes on a lot of things that are happening.
Okay.
And I'm wondering who's overseeing the reconstruction and hiring the level of the Homestake Reservoir.
Okay,
to
Carlo.
Take more water from the Colorado.
Thank you for that call. We'll see if we can get some answers. Many, many questions and comments in there. Maybe, Taylor, would you like to take this? In terms of, there are obviously many demands on water. We're looking at ski resorts, you know, snowmaking. He mentioned there a very specific case happening in Chaffee County, water being bottled water to be sold then. Any thoughts then on some of the comments that Carlo made?
There is a lot of demands on the river, whether it's the Colorado River or on our rivers on the east slope or the Front Range. And we are working in Colorado. There's a state water planning process that's ongoing right now. Wayne and I are both involved in that. And we're looking for solutions. We're looking to find ways to be sustainable in the state. And I think we are going to have to take a hard look at energy use, for water for energy use. We're going to have to prioritize some things. We're going to have to find balances. I think the agreement that Jim mentioned is a great example, the cooperative agreement, where we can find solutions. We just need to have a shift in our political will to find those solutions that are sustainable.
Well, does this have to be a zero-sum situation, given the many demands on the Colorado River and indeed all the water systems in the entire western U.S.? Does it have to be a situation with winners and losers? I mean, are there proven collaborations that you can point to say, well, yes, we can actually please most people most of the time?
Well, I certainly hope that we can find solutions and it's not a zero-sum game, because from my experience, the reason the environmental community is involved is because often the loser is the environment. And so we're trying to find solutions. And so we believe that if we're at the table, we can craft solutions with others who are like-minded, who want to find solutions. And we do have examples. The Colorado River Cooperative Agreement is one. We worked on a project on Elkhead Reservoir, which is up in the northwest part of the state, where we enlarged a reservoir and basically split the water between endangered fish, the community, and agriculture and power. And so I think we've got examples of that. But we've been working on this in Colorado to find a path forward for our future. We know that we have a shortfall to meet municipal needs on the Front Range. So we are going to have to do things differently. I think we're going to have to look for ways of sharing water with farmers. Perhaps we ask farmers to fallow at times so that we can provide more water to cities and rivers in times in dry years. So I think there's solutions out there, but it's going to take we need to move away from that history of fighting. And there's a saying in the West, you know, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And it certainly is our history, but I think we need to move away from that.
We'll be going back to the phones, Jed in the North Fork Valley, in just a moment. Just a reminder that this is Connecting the Drops. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back. This is Connecting the Drops, a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio and the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. We're talking about the Colorado River tonight. And Maeve, I believe we had a caller.
We do have a caller. We'll go next to Jed. Jed, you're calling in from Somerset in the North Fork Valley. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Thanks for taking my call. I guess it's just a general question regarding to what extent stakeholders are projecting decreased snowpack and increased liquid runoff like we're currently seeing, but later into the fall and beginning earlier in the spring, that might require for the management and government of flow, installation of greater reservoir capacity to offset that difference, and given the additional cost of implementing something like that as an approach to mitigating the effects of climate change, where additional financing could be had.
Jed, thank you for your call. Wayne Vandersheer with the Colorado Springs Water Utility, do you maybe have an answer to Jed's question regarding diminishing snowpack and solutions to that?
I think there's a general agreement that we're looking at warmer conditions and projections for diminishing snowpack, but also a higher degree of variability in snowpack and precipitation, and how that kind of combination of those changes result in stream flow and runoff and yield for anyone who's dependent on the Colorado River is still, I think, science that's yet to be fully resolved. So one thing we have seen, though, is generally in the last number of years, a departure from traditional snow pack reliability and variability that we saw, say, back in the 1990s.
This goes back to Taylor's point that we're in the future of water looks very, very different from the history of water. Wayne, maybe you can expand on this. We touched on it earlier around proven cooperative agreements with water use, particularly on the Colorado River. Are we seeing successful collaborations that we can look to as models for the way forward for water management?
We absolutely have to find the collaborative agreements. We have a collaborative agreement with Aurora and the West Slope for our Eagle River water rights that we'll look forward to executing as we go forward in the coming years as well. So those kinds of agreements and the Denver West Slope Cooperative Agreement and other agreements that are sort of out there, sort of in the formulation stages, are absolutely essential. Our agreements with Pueblo here in the Arkansas Valley are also another model for sort of intrabasin cooperative agreements. So I think the era of cooperation and smarter management of all the water resources that we have is absolutely essential.
And Wayne, can those agreements work in tandem with existing water law, or are you looking for ways to work together that's completely separate from what has become a very, very complex system of laws governing water in the state?
I think most of the agreements generally recognize the prior appropriation system as the bedrock of our water system in the state, and so most of them don't. That I'm not aware of, don't go to sort of overturn that law and those traditions, but they do tend to provide more flexibility and creativity of how to operate within those guidelines.
Well, Wayne, I know that you, along with Taylor Hawes, you have served on the Planning Commission for the State Water Plan. Taylor, maybe you can just tell our listeners exactly what is the State Water Plan and how does it relate to our conversation today on the Colorado River?
Certainly. Governor, so there has been a process in place for the last 8 to 10 years of stakeholders in the state working on developing solutions, assessing data. What's our shortfall for the future? We expect about 500,000 acre foot shortfall in the state of Colorado, especially focused on the Front Range here, trying to meet municipal needs. And we are now looking for a path forward. And it includes conservation. It includes working with agriculture to maybe bring more water from agriculture, but not in a buy and dry, which is when you just take water off the farms. It's more fallowing agreements. You pay the farmer interruptible supply agreements. They're looking for a project off of the Colorado River. So they call that new supply. And And then we're also looking to have high success rate on existing projects that are already in the works, like the Moffitt project that Jim mentioned. And so we've been in this process for 8 years. The governor in earlier this year signed an executive order to come up with a state water plan. And there's a planning commission type group that's working on this, and they have until and the Water Conservation Board, which is the lead agency for water policy matters in Colorado, they have until end of 2014 to come up with a draft. And that is supposed to give us a framework and a path forward for how we meet our future water needs, but also protecting our rivers and our recreational economy. So we're working on that now. There's also, in addition to the overarching state organizations working on this, each basin has a roundtable, and it's made up of stakeholders from county government and local government and recreation interests and environmental interests and agriculture. And they are all supposed to be working on their own solutions. So if you're in the Gunnison Basin or the Colorado, you're looking for solutions for your basin. But those should roll up to a statewide plan. And that's we've got our work cut out for us.
That's Taylor Holes. She is my guest in the KGNU studios in Boulder. She's the Nature Conservancy's Colorado River Program District. Earlier, we heard from Wayne Vandersheer. He's joining us by phone, and he is the manager for Water and Wastewater Planning, Water Resources Engineering, Conservation, and Forest Service Asset Management for Colorado Springs Utilities. You are listening to Connecting the Drops. Back to you, Eric, at KDNK.
Thank you, Maeve.
Well, Jim Pokrant, I have a question for you since you are involved with the Colorado Basin Roundtable, which is one of nine roundtables
Correct.
Throughout the state. What is the biggest challenge that the roundtables are facing?
The biggest challenge, whether it's us or the statewide plan, is to come up with a balanced solution. We're using the metaphor of the four legs of the stool, and that's been referenced with, you know, agriculture, new supply, which is a new Colorado River project, conservation, and reuse. So the two big places there potentially, there's agriculture. That's where 80% of the water in the state is being consumed, being put to work, and agriculture is actually the big target if you ask me. And, of course, we're casting our eyes on the Colorado River, and while some of us aren't so sure that there's water to develop, and about if that should be the first tool out of the box or the last tool out of the box, Colorado believes that should be the last tool out of the box. But meanwhile, agriculture is out there, and it's already on the meat hook, and it's ready to be skinned alive if we don't do something to somehow balance our water supply gap. Solutions as population is going to grow. Because when we come back to a new supply project, forget about how you feel politically, morally, or environmentally about the Colorado River. If there were all the water in the world in it and you could do a huge project, it's still going to take 20 years or so, maybe 30 years, maybe 15. So what are you going to do in the meantime? And that's where we think you should pull these other tools out of the box and really go for concerted conservation, of which Colorado Springs is rather progressive, and they're a shining example of people doing good things, as is Denver Water and Aurora and others. So there's lots of good examples out there, but the trick is, does it become a very concerted statewide program? But agriculture is a thorny issue because water rights are private property rights, and they can be bought and sold at will, whatever the market will bear. So the real question is, perhaps, does agriculture want to be saved? You know, we want to save it as a state because it's our history, it's our de facto open space, it's food, it's culture, it's economy. But we've seen on the Eastern Plains where there's been by and dry, and local economies have collapsed, and that's a model that we don't want to go to statewide. So, to me, even though I represent the Colorado River District, I think agriculture is actually the first concern because that's where people are going right now.
That was Jim Pokrant, our guest in the KDNK studios, education and communications specialist for the Colorado River Conservation District. I'm also joined by KDNK reporter Amy Haddon Marsh.
You know, Jim Pokrant, you were talking a little bit, you just mentioned when you were talking about agriculture, how local economies can be impacted by the loss of agriculture. Can you go into a little more detail about that?
Sure. If a farmer decides to just sell out, which is his right or her right, It's their, in a sense, their retirement plan, and that's how it works in the free market system. So be it. But if enough of that happens, all of a sudden the John Deere dealer goes out, the fertilizer dealer goes out, and in the local communities, when land goes from agricultural to non-productive, there's an erosion of the tax base, property tax base. So they've seen on the in on the Eastern Plains how there's been an implosion from all those factors, and you know that's where we don't want to go. Now, we also get into discussion of West Slope agriculture versus East Slope agriculture. You know, we don't think West Slope should be sacrificed to save East Slope, but the cruel fact is that agriculture is linked on both sides of the Continental Divide, as are we as people. A lot of producers on the West Slope send their cattle to the Front Range for finishing. So, you know, to the degree that the feed might not be produced, or you know, the feedlots aren't able to stay in business, that's going to affect the West Slope ag. So, it's a really thorny issue. Earlier, there was, I think Taylor mentioned rotational fallowing. You know, that's one way for a producer to actually, you know, turn water into a crop without selling it off completely. And depending on the year, a portion of the water may be leased out and the producer gets income. So that's a win-win. Hopefully that bolsters the municipal supply and it keeps the farmer in business.
Well, what kind of values are reflected by these kinds of water conflicts?
Well, the ultimate conflict or conflicting of values is, do we want to be a state, I suppose, of lawns, of which we have plenty on the West Slope. So it's really lawns versus agriculture in some respects. So it's incumbent upon us as we try and ferret our way through this jigsaw puzzle to look at how we can develop and not build a residential infrastructure that reflects people who maybe moved here from North Carolina, Chicago, where they get 40 inches of rain a year, and that's how they want to landscape. This is still the West. That worked in the 1950s, 1960s, but now that we are looking at greater population growth and we're in the last increment of river development at best due to legal or hydrologic limits, we got to make some decisions.
Thank you.
That was Jim Pokrant, Education and Communications Specialist for the Colorado River Conservation District. Back to you, Maeve, at KGNU.
Thanks, Eric, and we will go back to the phones. We have Dieter in Carbondale. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call. The geologic reality is really the guiding factor that we need to follow here, and it just seems that these people that are involved with water management are just not understanding that matter. They always are looking for new water instead of looking at water savings and actually using less water. Now, water is the big problem, but I want to refer to our number one and two business, if you know what I mean, because in Colorado, compost toilets are still illegal. So here we're sending our pee and poop water down to California and Nevada, anyways, into Lake Powell. And we cannot preserve that water because it's illegal to install a compost toilet, which may use absolutely no water.
Peter, I'm going to ask you if you can just turn down the radio behind you there. We're kind of getting a little echo. And I will actually like to put some of these questions to Wayne Vandersheer at Colorado Springs. He is one of those guys, as you say, they're managing water. Wayne, are you looking for new water or are you really looking for ways to conserve the water that we have?
We're actually doing both, and let me talk about how we conserve our water. We have, and Jim rightly pointed out, and thank Jim for the compliment on a very aggressive water conservation and education program. Just last year, we had over 5,000 water fixtures, high-efficiency fixtures, rebated, saving 59 million gallons per year of water, and our education program reached out to over 25,000 people, adults in our K-12 school program as well. And when we flush our toilets, particularly the water under Colorado water law that's fully reusable, we treat that water to the Clean Water Act standards and grab that water back up and reuse it through our exchange program and through our non-potable system to be fully
consumed. So it doesn't, of course, in our direction, it doesn't end up in California. It would end up in Kansas if we didn't do that, but we do do it, and we're at about 99% effective reuse of that asset.
Well, Dieter, thank you for your call. We will go next to Valerie. You're calling in from Lafayette. Valerie, okay. Welcome to the show. What's your question?
I didn't have a question. I had comments to the last three callers.
Please go ahead.
The man that mentioned Nestle bottling water, and I totally agree with him that all bottled water that is not sustainable or actually steals it from other people like Fiji water, that every just boycott every product they make. Boycott worked for Cesar Chavez back when. And any, like, swimming pool water, my daughter thought of this one years ago. She was in CU and college there. And any pool water, because a lot of people have pools, could go right straight into a holding facility for toilets instead of having to flush toilets with clean water. And we actually have a composting toilet up on the mountain because there's not water up there, and that they work very well, and they could be modified to work even better. And another thing people have to be concerned about is all this water that we keep drinking is becoming more and more dangerous to drink because you can't, a lot of things are 100% soluble in water, like plutonium and a lot of people's meds and stuff, and they keep building up year after year after year and probably contributes to a lot of the health problems and things going on right now.
Well, Valerie, thank you very much for calling in from Lafayette. Taylor Hawes with the Nature Conservancy. I'm going to ask you about maybe, do we have to just completely rethink our attitude towards water use? As Valerie said there, I mean, we're used to going to the store buying bottled water. We see people drinking bottled water all the time, and yet we have local water utilities in Colorado winning national awards for the quality of the water. And so do we just have to have a complete attitude shift as water consumers?
Well, it's a very complicated question. I think our water utilities are some of the best in the world in terms of their ability to treat water and get it to high quality. But Valerie's right. There are things that are accumulating in our water, birth control pills, Prozac. So there are contaminants that we still haven't figured out how to treat yet. Now, that shouldn't – I don't think that's the biggest concern. I mean, that's something that we need to figure out. And that's in our system here in Colorado, we have a water quality control group, and then we have water rights and water utilities, and they're somewhat separate. And I think we're going to be, the water quality control side of the equation is looking very closely at these issues and working to find solutions. On the water management side, I think everything people can do makes a difference. You know, Jim did mention that 80% of the water is in agriculture. That's one bucket that we need to focus on, how we might move water from agriculture to cities and to the environment. But when it comes to finding solutions in your home, there are lots of things people can do, whether it's buying water smart fixtures, taking out lawn. Every drop adds up. So we can take a new attitude towards being responsible users of water. You can make choices about what you eat. Beef uses a lot more water than vegetables. You don't have to stop eating beef, but you know, you eating more vegetables actually has a lower water footprint. So being a good consumer, thinking about your landscaping makes a big difference. Using xeriscape plants, which are ones that require less water. So we do have to think differently about our water use as individuals. But I think as a society, we still have a long way to go. We think water, we turn on the tap and water comes out. And we need to understand that they come from rivers, they have impacts. We are taking water from one community to another. We have impacts on those communities. So we do have to take responsibility as citizens and make choices that are good water choices.
Well, just as a note to end on before our next break, Taylor, I think that's interesting because so many water users in the Front Range now seeing exactly our relationship to water up close and personal because so much of our water system's compromised, whether we're under a water boil advisory or being told to limit our water consumption. And so people do have to really face our water use. That was Taylor Hawes. She is my guest in the KGNU studio. She's the Nature Conservancy's Colorado River Program Director. She's one of our guests as part of this Connecting the Drops. And we are talking tonight about the Colorado River. We do have some callers from Colorado Springs. We're going to get to them in just a moment. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome back. This is Connecting the Drops, a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio and the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. Here in Carbondale, we're joined by KDNK reporter Amy Hedden Marsh and Jim Pokrant, Education and Communication Specialist for the Colorado River Conservation District. I believe we have some calls at KGNU.
We do indeed, Eric. We're going to get to those live callers in just a moment. But we did have a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. Their question is it true that California water rights on the Colorado River supersede Colorado's rights? Jim Pokrant, maybe that's a question you can take.
Speaking about water rights per se, no, they don't supersede our water rights. But what that question directs itself to is the Colorado River Compact that Taylor referenced, when the river was split with 7.5 million acre feet to the lower basin states and 7.5 million to the upper basin states. By the way, the river doesn't produce our 7.5 million. But when that deal was made in 1922, the deal with the devil was that the lower basin's water rights would be the better half, in that if there are shortages, there's mechanisms in place that make sure that there's consistent water deliveries to the lower basin. It's a running 10-year average of 75 million acre feet. So that's how the lower basin actually benefits perhaps a little bit better from the Colorado River Compact than the upper basin. But so you have to wonder, water rights are first in time. And certainly back in 1922, the lower basin was developing faster. So you have to wonder why they made the deal with upper basin to split the river. And that's because they needed what's now known as the Hoover Dam for water storage and flood control. So we got a guaranteed cut of the river. It's just not all of our cuts showing up. And their cut is going to show up unless we go into drastic shortages.
Well, we're going to go back to the callers. Barbara in Colorado Springs, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. I have a comment, and I'm very concerned about our recent oil and gas boom in Colorado. Oil and gas development in Colorado requires water, a great deal of it. According to the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, the initial drilling of an oil and gas well requires up to 600,000 gallons of water. In addition, hydrofracking that drilled well requires 1 to 5 million gallons of water. This is enough water to sustain a community of 166,000 to 296,000 people for a year. Fort Collins, Colorado's fourth largest city, is less than 166,000 in population. 296,000 is similar to the populations of either Douglas County, Boulder County, Larimer County, or Weld County. After the well is drilled in an oil and gas field, and the fracking process causes oil and gas to flow upward, huge quantities of wastewater accompany this process. Wastewater is so contaminated with toxic chemicals and carcinogens that have been inserted down into the ground that it must be disposed of by injecting it 10,000 feet beneath the Earth's surface in special wells, never to return again to be used by living creatures. This water cannot be recycled. It's too toxic.
Well, Barbara, we'll try and get an answer for your question and comment. Maybe as you're in Colorado Springs, Wayne Vandersheer with the Colorado Springs Utilities, do you have an answer to Barbara?
Another point I wanted to make before you begin to respond is that my concern is, and we're all familiar with the natural cycle of water, where the rain falls from the heavens and then is taken up in the lakes and the streams and the river and the oceans, and then is drawn up by evaporation into the clouds again where it falls. It's a fixed amount of water. And this process forever removes from this natural cycle this huge quantities of water.
Barbara, thank you for your questions there. Wayne Vandeshear with Colorado Springs Utilities. What's your response?
Well, I can't speak to the caller's numbers, but when there were some local energy interests here in Colorado Springs looking at the prospect of drilling and hydrologic fracking, we looked at their water consumption, and while the numbers appear large, when you look at the absolute numbers in relative to our total demand and yield, they were in the tenths of a percent in terms of the amount of water that they would call on our system. They did do some test wells and have since moved on because they didn't find adequate resources to pursue those. So concerning the wastewater, there is a rather comprehensive state regulations around the operation of these wells, as well as the water, wastewater, and other operations that I'd call your attention to that are heavily regulated to prevent that contamination of the water supplies.
Taylor Hose, is this something you'd like to talk about? Because not just Barbara, who's calling in from Colorado Springs, we've had many, many shows here on KGNU. I know KDNK as well. Many listeners are very concerned about the impact of the oil and gas industry on water, whether it is water consumption or water contamination. What are your thoughts?
I used to actually practice water quality law in addition to water rights law, and we went before the Water Quality Control Commission on stormwater regulations around oil and gas facilities. And it was actually an interesting discussion because the Water Quality Control Commission's charge is to make sure they protect water quantity. And so I think we are kind of headed for a day of reckoning between those two sectors. And I would say that at the end of the day, water quantity and quality is going to be more important for this state because it's such a precious resource. Now, on the flip side, it is a difficult decision and a difficult choice because of, I would say that Colorado is in the epicenter of America's quest for energy independence. And so we do want to become self-sufficient as a country. And so we're in one of these difficult times of figuring out trade-offs between oil and gas that everybody uses, as well as water, which is such a precious resource here. So I think those discussions are still happening. I agree. There's some things that we need to work out as a state to make sure we are really making sure that our water quality and quantity is protected.
Is this being looked at as part of the state water plan?
It has not been looked at as the state water in the state water plan. In fact, it doesn't come up very much because we're so focused on trying to just meet basic needs. But I think if it starts to infringe on our ability or reduce the amount of water we have available to meet municipal needs in the state, as well as for our rivers and a recreation economy and for farmers, it's hard to know what people will choose and kind of where the politics will land. But I do know that our governor is very supportive of oil and gas. It creates jobs. But, you know, you have to look at which one is irreplaceable, and water is irreplaceable.
You know, Jim, in keeping with this energy theme, I have a couple of questions. But where is the energy sector getting its water?
In some cases, they've bought agricultural rights here on the West Slope, and they've converted them. They're buying the water. Otherwise, I know that's true on the Front Range, too, where actually the gas drilling industry is even bigger almost than what's happening on the West Slope. And so they're buying water from the Colorado Big Thompson system and municipalities. So, but in the bigger picture, I think the central question, aside from quality issues, is the competition for water. Mm-hmm. And we here on the West Slope are concerned about whether there's going to be a oil shale industry, and if there is, that could be a very big consumptive factor. And the Colorado Basin Roundtable and the Yampa White Green Basin Roundtable, we did a joint study to try and figure this out, because looking at the gap, you know, here's another competitive force for water. And we determined that, a middling energy industry with oil shale being produced would take about 148,000 acre-feet of water a year. Now, what we thought at that time was gas drilling was not, it's using water, but not in huge numbers relative to what the oil shale industry can do. But we've had a change of heart, and we're going to go back and restudy what the gas drilling industry is using, because from a quantity standpoint, where we thought each well was maybe on the order of 2 acre feet, you know, with all this directional drilling, where the one driller can go in all the different directions, the water use is much higher. So we have to reckon with that number. But what it fits in is to the future. You know, if there is an oil shale industry, you know, and we're going to have 10 million more people, or 5 million more people, bringing us up to 10, there's one more competitive factor.
Taylor Hawes, in addition to drought and the consumption of water and the many people who are drawing water from the river, what are some of the other major threats to the Colorado River?
Hydrology, and, you know, you said drought, but the way water is falling, our climate variability, all of that is changing and challenging water managers and stakeholders along the river to meet our needs. We're having shortfalls even in years that are not extremely dry. There's local shortages for farms here in Colorado. Down in Las Vegas, Lake Mead and Lake Powell are dropping. Lake Las Vegas right now is in a situation where if they, within the next year or two, their main intake to take water from Lake Mead to Las Vegas could be high and dry, which means Las Vegas will not have enough, you know, they won't be able to deliver their water from Lake Mead, which would be devastating economically, socially. We can't even imagine a city that has no water. And then there's also environmental issues that we're struggling with. We have 42, 43 native species in this river basin. 30 of those fish species are found nowhere else in the world. 4 of those have already gone extinct, and another 16 are imperiled or threatened. And so we have a lot of challenges on this river. We have mercury issues. We have something called dust on snow, where there's a lot of activity in the desert from cattle grazing, ATV use. That's creating dust storms that are ending up on our snow, making it melt faster. So we certainly have no shortage of challenges. But the biggest one we're facing is just trying to balance all these demands.
We'll go back to the phones. Will in Carbondale, welcome to the show. We just have a couple of minutes. What's your very brief question or comment this evening?
Hi, I'm a little off topic here in that it's not necessarily directly related to the Colorado River, but with the discussion about water contamination, I was curious if any of the experts on the eastern slope there could comment on what's going on with the flooding and, you know, the various wells on that side of the divide.
Okay. Wayne Vandersheer in Colorado Springs, do you have an answer to that?
Well, the flooding is just devastating, and I think it's too early to tell exactly what the impact are on folks that are relying on wells. I know nearby, right where I am, where the Black Forest fire was, one of the issues was that they were largely on shallow groundwater wells for those homes had out there, and they've been contaminated as the ash kind of runs across the ground and into those wells. So there has been damage there. I think it's too early to tell exactly, you know, how the wells are going to survive, operate in the future. We just got to wait this out. I was sitting here wishing, and I was listening to Taylor and Jim. I said, it's too bad we can't translate this awful rain and terrible flooding and property damage and loss of life into a miraculous snowpack this winter.
That's Wayne Vandersheer with Colorado Springs Utility.
Well, I just want to take this energy thing just a little bit further. Do you think, Jim Pogrant, that water shortages or potential water shortages could impact the amount of energy extraction that occurs here on the Western Slope?
You're coming down to the competition for water, and if as long as the water rights system stays intact and the energy companies have water rights and priority, they're going to be able to use them. To the degree that causes civic distress, I guess there might have to be some kind of deal to fix that.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up the simulcast for us tonight. Here in Carbondale, we want to thank our guests, KDNK reporter Amy Haddon Marsh and Jim Pogrant, communications specialist for the Colorado River Conservation District.
And here at KGNU, I'd like to thank Taylor Hawes. She's the Nature Conservancy's Colorado River Program Director. She recently testified before a Senate committee on the Colorado River. Joining us by phone was Wayne Vandersheer. He is the General Manager for Water and Wastewater Planning, Water Resources, Engineering, Conservation and Forest Service Asset Management for Colorado Springs Utilities. This program was produced by KGNU, KDNK, and KRCC as part of Connecting the Drops, a year-long series from Rocky Mountain Community Radio in partnership with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. The Colorado Foundation for Water Education is the only nonpartisan, nonprofit water educator in Colorado, promoting a better understanding of the state's water resources and issues. To become fluent in Colorado water, visit the foundation online at yourwatercolorado.org.
We had production assistance from Steve Skinner, Sam Fuqua, and Andrea Chalfin. On the technical side, special thanks to Joel Bellick at KRCC, as well as John Banks here at KDNK and Evan Perkins at KGNU.
For Connecting the Drops, I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder.
And I'm Eric Scalak at KDNK in Carbondale. Thanks for listening.